You're about to hear Michael Moore, director of Bowling for Columbine and Roger and Me, and the author of Stupid White Men, give a keynote speech at Webzine 2001 last summer in the basement of CBGB's in New York City. Webzine is an annual event celebrating independent publishing on the internet. It is a 100% volunteer-driven event and features hundreds of the leading independent online media creators around the globe. For more information on the Webzine event and how you can start one in your own city, visit our website at www.webzine.ws. Now, here's Michael Moore.
I want to introduce the great Michael Moore. Come on up, man. Grab the mic. It's all yours.
Well, thanks for having me here. And some people called and asked me if I would come and talk about my experience using the internet and our website and our little thing that we do. So, first of all, I'm a member of this, the baby boom generation, I guess. And I know it's truly somebody needs to do something about the baby boomers that are still in charge or ruining the world, because it. My generation is the single greatest force against anything new or good happening. I don't know how many people I know, how many friends of mine are just still put down the internet or don't even want to learn how to use it or get involved in it, and they, they're all very, they all love to talk about now how the internet's all failing or the .com thing is ending or whatever. I don't, some kind of bullshit that they. They like to believe it's true, because I'm one of that generation, I share a certain amount of that ignorance, and I didn't really myself understand what was going on until maybe about 1994. We had TV Nation, it was the show that we had on NBC, and my wife was really into the internet and computers, and she was working on computers back in the mid 70s, and. She logged on after one of our shows was over one night to a message board or a chat room or whatever. This would be 94, so it still wasn't, it hadn't really kind of exploded at that point. But I was just stunned how minutes later after the show ended that people were talking about these things that we just aired on television. And it was such, up until this point, up until the invention of this thing, this ability for all of us to communicate with each other without the middleman, if you had a show on national television, it was all a one-way thing. I would put my thing out to you, and that would be the end of it. Man, maybe you'd get a few fan letters, but I'd never write a fan letter, and most of you probably wouldn't write a fan letter. So, you never really heard from the bulk of the people watching the show. And so to see these literally hundreds of comments and discussion taking place within minutes after the show is over really blew my mind. And so we put up my wife's email address in this discussion, and the next day she had 300 emails from people. And right away I began to see that this is truly one of the greatest things to happen in my lifetime, because the egalitarian nature of this is such that suddenly, before, if you wanted to, let's say if you wanted to say something to the country, you would have to do what I had to do, which was somehow, go barreling headfirst through some door in Hollywood and come out, bloodied and bruised and battered and in the hopes of getting, your thing on TV. And I'm a rare fluke and an exception to people like us, because people like us aren't supposed to be on TV. We're not, and our films are not supposed to be distributed by Hollywood studios. That's just not the way it's set up. And so, because of whoever was asleep at the wheel or whatever mistake was made that I was able to get in, once in, I figured I better try and do some good or create some havoc here or get some other people in through the door. while I had it slightly ajar. So I began to see that this whole thing with the web and the internet, there was just like this incredible thing where you no longer had to go and make a pitch to some Hollywood executive to be able to speak to millions of people. That there was a device to do that. I mean, I don't know how. I mean, probably to most of the people in this room, it's you're well aware of how incredible the last decade is in terms of what's happened. But I don't think really those who write about our culture and the culture police whose job it is to stop us really fully comprehend the incredible revolution that has taken place. Because never before in the history of mankind have human beings been able to communicate on a mass level to other human beings without going through the owners of whatever the device was that got the word out. You know, whether it was the people that, you know, ran City Hall or the people who owned the newspaper, you could send a letter to the editor, but they would determine whether or not the letter would be published and what of it would be published. If you wanted to get something on television, you could go to your cable access station maybe and get something on it at 2 in the morning and have 17 people see it. But with radio, there was a time, and I feel that what we're going through now is very much like the early days of FM radio, which maybe a lot of you aren't old enough to remember what that was like, but it was FM was considered some bastard stepchild of the form of radio, and so it wasn't really used much. Yet there were all these frequencies that existed, and people would start up stations and just start playing whatever they wanted to play, in whatever order they wanted to play it in. There was actually a time when that happened, and that new voices could be heard. And if my buddies and I, if we had a band back in high school, we could literally drive over to the radio station with a tape and get it played on the air. That actually happened. That now one company owns, well, actually two companies own virtually all the radio stations, commercial radio stations in this country. These two companies now are up to owning 75% of all the radio stations. So it all sounds alike, and it all sounds like crap. And because it's mostly people in my generation that are these owners, they make sure that no new voices, no new bands, no new music ever really gets heard. Or if it's heard, it's put into some sort of niche, you know, some alternative kind of, you know, freaky, fringy thing that's off there, but not considered standard or mainstream or available to the general public. So this has never happened before, you know, other than in those few short years with FM radio, where the people could actually communicate with each other and on a mass scale, not just writing a letter to a friend and putting a stamp on it, you know, or posting your grievances on the wall that, you know, maybe a few hundred people would see that. Or maybe there would be a large rally or a demonstration in Washington, D.C. Maybe you would end up speaking to 100,000 people. But what amazed me is that back in 1994, with this initial experience, is that within a few short weeks, and NBC was deciding whether or not to keep the show on the air, we just put the word out on our we didn't have a site then, it was just through my wife's email address and on these message boards, that NBC was thinking of not renewing the show. And so within, I think, maybe 5 days, NBC received over 55,000 emails from people around the country. Now, this is 1994, so again, you've got to remember, this is, it still wasn't at the explosive, you know, and mass stage that it's at now. And it totally flipped them out at NBC. And in fact, they offered us to come back as a result of these emails, and we came back in December and did an end-of-the-year special. And then more mail came in, and we took the sacks of these emails over to Fox to see if we could even get a better deal with them, and they did, and they put us on over at Fox. So the Internet was responsible for all that, the people, you know, having their say and letting the network know in a way that went way – you got to understand, if a show on television gets maybe 10 letters, they think that's like a revolution going on. You know, like 10 anti, you know, abortion people will send a letter, and you know, they'll just go nuts and start pulling everything, you know, from like 10 letters. So to get 55,000 letters, it had never happened before. Nothing they had ever put on the air had ever received 55,000 of anything, even phone calls. It had topped anything in there. Nothing had nothing in their experience to relate to this. So it certainly showed me that this had this is way beyond anything you could ever hope for. And it's not just about, geez, how could we send letters to get a stupid TV show on the air, but rather that if we somehow can keep this in our hands, that it's a very powerful force. And of course, the other powerful forces out there, those of commerce and of the political establishment in Washington, their goal is to figure out how to use the internet for their best interest, to make money and to control us. And so the battle is raging, essentially, and we're right in it right now. You know, will this remain? Will this be this egalitarian device, this revolutionary thing that allows all of us to communicate with each other, to organize, to get together, to do whatever it is that we want to do and say whatever it is we want to say without censorship, you know, or will the forces of evil win and control it, stifle it, segregate it, and continue to make sure that the, I don't know what the latest numbers are, but the, you know, I mean, how many people in the country now have are on the internet, are hooked in? Is it, what's 50% maybe? 60? It's somewhere in there. But that means that there's another half of the country that's not wired. There's another half of the country that's not hooked up. And when at the end of this, my last documentary, the big one, and there was a scene where I talking to Phil Knight about the children that he uses in his sweatshops in Asia, and I challenged him to come and build a factory in the third world of Flint, Michigan, and he won't do that. But he, I then said, why don't you give some money to the schools? And he says, I'm not going to do that. And I said, well, I'll put up $10,000 if you put up $10,000 for a school in Flint. And he said, okay, I'll do that. So we took the $20,000 and built a computer lab at the Forest Elementary School in Flint. And I went to see the principal there, and I said, how many do you think of your kids here are online at home or on the internet, have computers and are hooked up? She said, oh, I think it's between 1% and 2%. 1% and 2%. And in other words, 98% of these kids are not either computer literate or have access. That's correct. So we thought, well, we'll bring all these computers into the school and get these kids hooked up and to try and catch up. But none of us should see any of this really as a victory yet, when half of us have the ability to do this and the other half don't. And that's what the previous generations did. That's what they made sure that a certain elite had the means, the ability to communicate, to travel, to educate, to do whatever, and the have-nots remain the have-nots. So that's another challenge of this new revolution and of your generation, to see to it that we don't just sit here and throw a party for this great thing that we're part of, but that we recognize that millions and millions of other people are not part of this party, and we must bring them into it. Because once they're into it, once they're part of this, then it becomes really scary, because they're the ones who really are on the shit end of what's going on in this country right now. And once we're able to organize with them and they with us, that is going to be an incredibly powerful moment. And the chance to try and create social or political change is absolutely incredible. Since that time in 94, I've had many experiences, too numerous really to cite, in terms of once we got a website set up and started putting the word out about different things, whether it was a demonstration taking place here or a letter campaign that needed to start there or some kind of ruckus that people needed to create wherever. It was amazing that by getting the word out, how many people you literally could get to show up at a demonstration the very next day. There was this one thing we did where we organized this in we just said, you know, show up at the local if there's any kind of like, you know, Murdoch affiliate or anything that's owned by Rupert Murdoch, the next day at noon, people around the country are going to show up and protest the particular thing. And we got reports back from about 42, 43 cities that had some sort of protest, whether they went to their local Fox affiliate or whatever. And it was an amazing thing to see, because I remember, you know, again, in my generation, if you wanted to organize, a nationwide demonstration, it would be months and months of work just to get the word out and to figure out how to get everybody someplace. And the fact that that can happen literally within hours now is something that the powers that be just must not like. And we need to see the power of that. We need to see that the incredible power that we have in our hands here that we can hopefully do some good with. I would assume most of the people here, I've only talked to a few people since I came in, but I assume most of you are, you know, pretty well versed, and you know you have your own sites, you have your own zines, you have, you know, you're into this pretty deep. And I would think that the next level that we all need to figure out where to take this to is how to get this beyond, in maybe many of your cases, just a small group of friends or people in your communities, to an even larger and wider group of people. And I hope that's being discussed. And I hope that you know, together we can find these ways to make this thing move and move in a way that reaches as many people as possible and cuts out the middleman as much as possible. Now, I started my first underground paper when I was in fourth grade. The nuns, I was in Catholic school, the nuns shut it down. I started up again in sixth grade, the nuns shut it down again. I started again in eighth grade, the priest shut it down in eighth grade. But I've always enjoyed writing, and I've always liked just the power of the word and being able to figure out ways to communicate to an audience and not just preach to the converted, not just have some kind of jerk off fest with each other so that we all sit around and nod in agreement, but to really try and reach as wide of an audience as possible and realize that there are people out there that maybe they aren't as far along as you are, but the doors are open and they're listening and they're willing to listen and they want to hear things. And we have to find ways to say those things so that it's not just the same group of people over and over again trying to make change occur in this country. I started up my own regular newspaper, a weekly alternative paper called the Flint Voice, when I was, 22 years old. And I did that for about 10 years. In the middle of that, we ran a story about 5 years into it on the local mayor in Flint and some of the illegal things that he was doing. And he got wind of the article and got a court order from the judge. And the police went in and seized the printing place right off the press of the printer that we used to print the paper. And this created a big ruckus, and it was made national news. And the whole thing ended up we ended up going to Congress and testifying, and a bill was passed, a shield law, to protect journalists from unreasonable newsroom searches from police. So I had a very early experience with this, with how those in power want to put a stop to anything that they don't think is in their best interest. And of course, we weren't wealthy enough to own the presses then. The printing presses cost quite a bit of money. And I remember actually when we finally could afford to pay a monthly fee for what was called a compugraphic typesetting machine. And these things were like still, it's like $70,000-$80,000, and I don't know, we paid like $500 a month on it. It was just some horrible, you know, amount of money that we couldn't afford. But at least we owned, you know, like part of the means. You know, the old cliche about freedom of the press is for those who own the presses, and I think there's a lot of truth to that. And the police could literally go in and take that off the press. Now, with the internet, it's a little harder for them. As you've heard here today and before I spoke, they still like to go in and seize things. They're just inclined to do that. Just, I don't know, whatever it is in their DNA, in their nature or whatever, but they're just the thought police, and who are oftentimes real police, like to go in and take things that aren't theirs. We need to fight that and stand up against that and oppose that and get laws passed so that your computer has the same protections that the newsrooms of America have, based on this law that I and others worked to get enacted back many years ago. I don't know if we should open some questions here, or if I could tell you some more stories, or I don't know. I like to actually be helpful, so I didn't have a chance to talk to a lot of people here, so I'm not quite sure, you know, what would be helpful to the group here. But and we can get a discussion going. And you should also let me have it. I mean, you know, ask me why I'm on AOL. You know, just why do I how do you know my eating habits? Oh, she wanted to know in the big one. There's a scene in there of me eating at McDonald's. I put that in there because I wanted to show that I'm a flawed human being. The last thing I want is for no. That is all it is. Yeah, I like you, am filled with many contradictions, and I don't like people to make movies and do things to turn themselves into some sort of star or celebrity that's up on some kind of pedestal. I'm horribly flawed and in need of a lot of help, and that's why I put it in the movie. It's the truth. It's.
All right. Well. I know it's not cool to be a fan, but
you
I'm
have a
fan.
Microphone and a drink in your hand.
Yeah,
combination.
And I'm pretty damn lit too. I just want you all to know. Former panelists getting liquored up here. You know, I'm not wearing underwear. You don't want to see it. Anyway, my name is Bill Lessard, and I run a site called netslaves.com.
Yes.
And myself and the gentleman right there, raise your hand, get some props. We wrote a book called Net Slaves, True Tales of Working the Web. And we wrote this book.
I own that book.
Come on, dude. You're kissing my ass.
No.
I'm supposed to kiss your ass.
No. I'm really honored to meet you, actually. I love
it. Are you swear? Come
yeah,
on,
it's
dude.
True.
Really?
True. Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I got to tell you. No, I shouldn't tell you.
We wrote that book in 3 months. I know it kind of sucks at certain points, but, you know, we did our best. But anyway, here's my question. The situation that a lot of dot-com workers are going through are analogous. It's currently analogous to what happened, you know, in Flint, Michigan. I mean, a lot of people are out of work. I mean, myself, I don't know where my next dollar is coming from. See, it's the liquor talking. What would you say to us to like how what inspiring words or something just to keep ourselves going? I mean, what would you say, really?
Drink less.
No, come on, dude. Seriously, what would you say?
I would say that it's not analogous to Flint of the late 1990s. But it is analogous to Flint of 1910. In 1910, there were something like 65 auto companies in America. 65. 65 separate, different automobile companies. It eventually became three, and now two, if you count the Mercedes people as being Germans. Because I don't see it that way. I just see they don't see themselves as Americans or Germans or whatever. They're part of a global thing, and they could give a shit. So this part of this is a natural thing, in terms of if you have 1,000 dot coms, it's not going to, it's not ever going to be 1,000 dot coms. It's going to be less. Hopefully, it'll never be three, but it won't be 1,000. So I think that the solution for you or for the average worker in these various in this industry is to, instead of waiting around for the man or whoever that person is that, you know, has got a trust fund and it's going to start the next .com to then hire the next 100 people only to fire them a year later, that it behooves you and it is incumbent upon you and others here to realize that you yourself can create your own thing, that you can actually create, that you have it within you. I mean, it's just, it sounds like a fucking, you know, Tom, or what's that guy's name, that Robbins guy on late night TV?
Tony Robbins.
Yes, you! but listen, but my, we are taught from the time we are little kids that we're shit, and that we don't, that we can't do shit, can I just give you my little, my thoughts about this, actually, because if you don't, can I just go off for a second here? Because,
dude, feel free to free associate, dude.
I just think, this is what I don't know. In the first 5 years of our lives, we learn more, and it's really, it's downhill after that. I mean, because it is, think about this. When you're born, you don't know anything. And by the time they shove you into kindergarten or preschool, you have learned so many things on your own without the benefit of a teacher, a textbook, a desk, a test, a grading system, a state, you know, authorized test. You know, when you're born, you can't speak. By the time you're five, you have a vocabulary of 3,000 to 5,000 words. You have learned to speak a foreign language. You speak in complete sentences, paragraphs. You can communicate pretty clearly with adults. How did you do that? How did you learn a foreign language without going to school in those first 5 years? You did it through trial and error. Because in our first 5 years, it's okay to fuck up. It's okay to make a mistake. In fact, we're rewarded for it. You learn. That's how we're supposed to learn as humans. We're supposed to learn from our mistakes. As soon as you're put in first grade, though, it's like, you know, if you make any mistakes, you're flunked. You know, you're put in the bluebird group, you know, or the blackbird group, or whatever group you were put in, and you're tracked and you're fucked for the rest of your life, you know. But in the first 5 years, when you're trying to learn to speak the foreign language, it starts off where you're going goo goo gaga, and the adults around you don't go goo goo gaga. What the hell is that? Go to your room. You know, they nurture us. They love us. They don't flunk us. They go mama dada, and then we go mama dada. You know, then we try to walk and we fall down, and when we fall down, the parents don't go, what the fuck are you doing? You know, get up. They don't do that. They help us up, or they put little chairs, little stools around so we can like hold on, you know, and walk around. And eventually, you know, we fall down. They don't sit there with their martinis just having a laugh at us. Oh, look at that shithead falling on his face again. That's not how it is. You know, it's they help us. They help us. And every time we fail, we're loved. Every time we fail in those first 5 years, we're nurtured. And then we go to school. And then every time you fail, you're screwed. To the point to where now, as an adult, you wouldn't even think of starting your own thing. You wouldn't even... the fear of failure, the fear of fucking up, the fear of falling on your face is so intense in all of us that we've lost that sense of that it's good to fail. I need to fall on my face 3 or 4 times to figure out what's wrong. You know, I need to look at myself eating that Big Mac 1,000 times in the editing room to figure out what the fuck is wrong with me. You know, I mean, I just feel that the whole system is geared and set up. And you could, and if you, any of you are around any little kids or you have kids, you know what it's like to see a group of 4 or 5 year olds all excited and in love with life, and then walk through any high school in America and look at the juniors or seniors in high school shuffling through the hall, completely burned out, stoned literally or figuratively, just, you know, oh, I don't know, I'm going to go out in the smoking area and just, you know. I mean, that's, and it's just, it's like an invisible hypodermic needle's been put into our heads at 5 years old, and slowly it sucks, just goes right into our heads and numbs us out. And then we're shoved out in the real world and told, let's, you know, go participate now, go be citizens. And it's no surprise to me that the majority of young people don't vote or don't even think about doing something on their own that they could do. And I hated school. I couldn't stand it. I got in a lot of trouble. I kept my grades up so I wouldn't get punished for the trouble I caused. And it's the only thing where they don't know what to do with you, if any of you had that experience, where if you got A's and B's, you could, you know, create a lot of trouble and don't get caught smoking or any of those other rules that they set up to get rid of the troublemakers. Because it's not really the smoking they care about, because they all smoke themselves. It's not the drinking they care about. They all drink themselves. They just know that the troublemakers will tend to do those things, and so they, you know, that's how we're able to get rid of the people that are going to give us crap, because we want nice, sedate students who aren't going to rock the boat. Don't question authority. You can't fight City Hall. You know, that's the message. It's over and over and over and over again. I just spent a week out at Columbine because I've been making this documentary called Bowling for Columbine, and the title of it comes from the fact that Eric and Dylan, the two kids that did the killings that day, the one class I didn't want to miss that morning was a bowling class, and so they showed up for their first hour bowling class and went from, you know, one All-American sport to the other All-American sport. And but I met these kids there. One of them is in a wheelchair, and another one is he's got a bullet lodged between his spine and his aorta. The other bullet in the kid in the wheelchair is lodged in his stomach. And the bullets were bought over the counter at Kmart. And so I said to the kids, you know, why don't we get on a plane and go to Detroit? Because that's where the Kmart world headquarters is, outside of Detroit. And why don't we return the bullets that are inside you? And they said, great. So we just got on a plane, flew to Detroit. I wheeled them into the Kmart lobby and said, oh, we're here to return your blue light special. And we're not leaving until you stop selling ammunition for handguns and assault weapons in your stores. And we stayed there for 5 hours. The chairman wouldn't see us. Came back the next day. The next day we came back. One of the kids that night went to the Kmart closest to the world headquarters. He bought 1,000 rounds of live ammunition over the counter, including hollow points, 357 magnums, 9mm. And we went into wheeled into Kmart in the wheelchairs and plopped the bullets down and said, we're not leaving until the chairman sees us. Within 2 hours, the vice president came down. And by that time, a lot of press had heard about this and had gathered there and read a statement saying that within 90 days, Kmart was going to stop selling all ammunition for handguns and assault weapons. And that took 24 hours. And these kids, these teenagers, you know, we're talking afterwards. They're so blown away by the fact that just literally a plane ticket to Detroit and a 24-hour wait resulted in a massive change in policy at the second largest chain in America. That they were humiliated and forced to make this change by these kids who are crippled by these 17-cent bullets. And I said, you know, I can't wait till we put this in the movie, because the one thing I want kids, young people, teenagers to see when they see this film is that everything you've been told about how you can't fight City Hall, that you're just one person, that there's 280 million people in this country, you're just a little speck, you don't matter, you're insignificant. It doesn't. Why bother with that? Let's party. You know, it does matter. You do matter. You, one person, can make a difference. And history is filled with examples of where just one or two people have made the difference. The big massive changes throughout world history have not occurred with armies of people. It's occurred because a black woman down in Alabama didn't want to go and sit in the back of the bus because her feet were tired. That was it. Just some tired feet and a woman who was some conviction and willing to take a risk resulted in a massive social movement in this country. You know, Marx and Engels, I mean, these are just two old farts sitting around the fire in London, warming their hands, talking shit to each other. That's all that was. And by the time they were gone, they never knew anything would happen, you know. JC and his 12 guys who fished. You know, I mean, that's all they were. That's all it was. Look what that did, you know, for good or bad. Mostly bad. Some good. So, you know, I just want this. I just think that the more that you can realize that your little thing, wherever you all came from here tonight, and I assume you're all not from New York. I assume many of you came from different parts around the country. You don't count, though, because you asked me that question. she says she lives a couple blocks away. Anybody live four blocks away? Yeah. Oh, so you are New Yorkers. Okay, I'm sorry. Well, they'll put this on their website, and some kid in Omaha tomorrow night will see this. And that's the kid I want to say, you know, when you see this, don't let anybody in Omaha tell you, you live in Omaha, kid. Get real. This is Omaha. You're not going anywhere. You're not doing anything. This is Omaha. No, it's because it is Omaha and because it's you doing this, that's what's going to change things. That's where it's really going to happen. It's not going to happen with celebrities or stars or star fuckers. It's going to happen because a few people say, you know what, I got a good thing going here and I'm going to keep doing it and I'm going to do it. And to get back to your question, sometimes you can make a living at that and sometimes you can't. That's the yin and yang of it.
Yeah, but also a lot of luck, dude. It's also a lot of luck.
Well,
I've been lucky.
Huh?
We've been very lucky.
We've been lucky. Yeah. Well, a lot of it is luck, but you know what? It's a bit of everything, you know? It's luck, it is hard work, it's inspiration, it's being inspired, it's believing in your own dream, it's Tony Robbins, no. It's but you know, I know that's it's not a very concrete answer. I can't give you the answer. Where can you go get a job tomorrow doing this? But I believe that there are people in this room and people will see this that have the wherewithal to figure that out and to make something happen. And don't wait for somebody to make it happen for you. Don't wait for somebody in the Silicon Alley or Valley to make it happen for you. Because, you know, I speak at these indie film things and film schools, and you know everybody's waiting for their film grant, you know, or somebody's going to back them, or somebody knows somebody who's got an uncle who, in some agency. Man, if you are thinking like that, you will never go anywhere. You will be still sitting in the same shitty place you're in 10 years from now if you're waiting for somebody to give that to you. They're waiting for that grant. Just go out and make your movie. Just make it. Go into debt. Do whatever it is. If you believe in it, you will go into debt. Just go and do it. You know, roll the dice. And you'll fail. And you'll learn from the failure. You know, you can't get depressed by it. You can't let all those forces that have been in your head since you were a kid telling you because you failed, that means you suck. I'm here to say because you fail, that means you're great. And every time you fail, you get greater because you learn from that. And you figure it out, and you find your way.
You've been listening to Michael Moore's keynote speech at Webzine 2001 in CBGB's basement in New York City. For more information about Webzine and independent online publishing, visit our website at www.webzine.ws. Now, back to Michael Moore.
You know, I made Roger and Me. I didn't know dick about squat. I mean, I swear to God, no, seriously, I mean, I'm not. I went to college for a year at the University of Michigan Flint branch. You have to say Flint branch because the Ann Arbor people will get all upset. I see you got the Unabomber out there on the poster there. My sister and him lived on the same street. That's another story. Anyways, where was I? Oh, University of Michigan, Flint branch. And it was a commuter campus. I went there for a year, couldn't stand it. Showed up the first day of my sophomore year, drove around the parking lot for an hour, looking for a parking space, no parking spaces, driving around and around and around and around. And after about an hour, I just said, fuck it, I drop out. And I just drove home. I told my parents I'm dropping out. Why? I couldn't find a parking space. It's a true story. You can't drop out because you can't find a parking space. Well, that's why I'm dropping out. There's no goddamn parking spaces. I'm out. I'm not going. I've not sat in a desk since. And so making my first film, you know, that when I look at the film now, and I you know, the good feelings I have toward it is because I made it out of such ignorance and such stupidity and such naivete that and it never would have been what it was had I, you know, gone to school and learned the right way to make a documentary that where you can get a grant from the Michigan Council for the Arts, and then it'll be on PBS, and then maybe we'll show it in the art museum. And, you know, I just didn't have any of that in me, and I didn't know anything about how to operate the camera, and I had met these people here in the village that I had come to Flint to do a film called it was called Blood in the Face. It was a film on the Klan and the Nazis in the Midwest, and they when they were there, I kind of helped out. And then when I decided to make this film on Flint, I asked them if they would come back to teach me how to operate the camera and the equipment, and they said yes. And so they came there, and for a week, and that was my film school. But I would say for every roll of film that we could develop that turned out okay, there were 9 rolls that we had to ditch, that we just ruined. So what you saw on the screen in that film represented only 1/10 of what I actually shot, not because we didn't use the other footage, because the film, you know, was only going to be 1.5 hours long. It was because it was unwatchable because it wasn't exposed, or it got jammed in the gate, or whatever happened. We screwed it up. And I remember this one time where Jesse Jackson came to Flint, and we asked if we could do an interview with him. So we start in the interview, and he's looking down at the sound machine that we've got. It's called a Nagra. And he's saying, you know, the little button there, it's not in the right place. And I said, no, it's in the right place. Don't worry. And so I start asking my questions. And he stops about the second question. He goes, you know, the button isn't in the right place. I said, Reverend Jackson, you know, we're filmmakers. You know, we know where the button is, you know. Okay. So he goes through this whole interview, right? And he's in his convinced in his head the button isn't in the right place. Interview finishes, he gets in the car, he drives off. The sound guy is listening back to the tape. Nothing's there. He goes, Mike, the button wasn't in the right place. And I can't believe Jesse Jackson is like a film teacher to us. You know, I was like, what is wrong with us? You know, so we like chased him down the road, and he saw us coming at his next stop, and he's laughing at me like, you know, I told you the button wasn't in the right place, you know. I said, I'm so sorry. Will you give us the interview again? Yes. You know, so that's what it was like. Failure after failure, looking like an asshole, 9 days out of 10, and ending up with Roger and me. So who's got the next question?
I did.
Oh, yes, sir.
My name is Steve Gillard. I also write for Nuts.
Steve.
I also write for Nuts Slaves. Anytime we want to have a discussion on unions, we can be sure to get 4 out of 5 responses from people who believe that their futures lie with their bosses and have no idea of union history. When I wrote a piece for the site about the Flint sit-down strike, and maybe 2 people out of the people who make like the 20 or 25 responses we got had ever heard of it. And anytime you mention the word organization, you know, whether, you know, you get either hostile responses or blank stares or the statement, oh, IT people will never, never organize in a union. And I'm not saying we don't say whether we're pro union or anti union, but people are either ignorant or they think every union in America is like the Teamsters under
Hoffa 1 or Hoffa 2,
Hoffa or the guy from Cleveland they locked up. You know, I mean, and you have to explain. You know, when it was just so frustrating, and finally I did some research and explained how the Hollywood unions got organized. And it was all fights. It was like street fights. You know, you had the hairdressers and the longshoremen fighting the mobsters in the streets of Los Angeles. And I just, you know, what reaction do you get when this topic comes up, organizing unions?
Well, I mean, unions have been pretty successfully crushed, in my opinion. And unfortunately, all the lessons are going to have to be relearned, and all the fights and the struggles are going to happen again. And that's the short answer to that. My uncle was in the Flint sit-down strike. in the 1930s. If you were British, you would know about the Flint sit-down strike because they teach it in their schools. The BBC did a big documentary that they show in all the British schools on the five most important events of civilization or whatever, you know, from time to now. And number four was the Flint sit-down strike of 1936. And the reason that it's in that list is because up until that time in 1936, human beings were broken down pretty much into two groups, rich and everybody else. And everybody else, the workers, the serfs, the slaves, the whoever, there was no middle class. There never was a middle class until the unions created a standard of living where the average working person could, for the first time in the history of mankind, own their own home. Do you realize that? Not before 1936 did the average, you know, working type person or the person who was in that lower class of workers, you did not own property. You did not send your children to the university. You had no health care. You had no days off. You had none of this stuff. And the unions made all of that happen. And even by the time in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, even if your parents didn't belong to a union, you benefited from the fact that the unions did this, and so everybody else had to do it, even if their workers weren't union. And so suddenly people had paid vacations. Suddenly there was something called health insurance. Suddenly there were these things that existed that never existed before. And the generation that came next was the first generation that went to college. So it was a massive, massive event in the history of mankind that took place in Flint, Michigan, 1936. It's not taught in the schools in Flint, so don't feel bad. We live in an idiot nation. We're supposed to be ignorant so that we don't question authority, so that we don't vote, so that we don't make use of the democratic means that we have available to us. We're actually in charge still, on paper at least. We can still enforce that piece of paper if we chose to do that. That must be the scariest thing at all to the people in power, that there's still a piece of paper that says that we're in charge. And I always, if there's one thing I'll say to you tonight, and I try to say it to everybody that when I talk to a group like this, is that you must understand that that as long as that Constitution still exists, and it got pretty well shredded in this past year in the state of Florida and the U.S. Supreme Court, but the chairman. The chairman of General Motors has the same number of votes as every person in this room. One. That's it. He's only got one vote. He's got a lot of money, and he can try and buy the people that you vote for later, but he can't actually buy the votes at the polling place. He's got the same number of votes as you or I, one, and there's more of us than there are of him. And I got to tell you, hundreds of years from now, when anthropologists dig us up, they're not going to understand why we just sat on our ass when we had a means to take over, a means to be in charge. You know, I mean, since we've invented film and videotape in the last century, we're leaving now behind a film record of us running around saying things like, I'm free! I live in a democracy! You know? It's like, they're going to look at us like a few hundred years from now when hopefully everything is a lot better and free and democratic, and they're going to go, look at these assholes! They're like, you know, it's like the rulers, the ruling class, the rich, had two political parties doing their bidding for them. And that rich, the top 1% that controlled the majority of the wealth, the top 1%, owned two political parties, the two major political parties, and the other 99% had no political party. And yet that 99% ran around saying they lived in a democracy and they were free. We're going to look like the people 200 years ago that were using leeches on their bodies. You know, the way we like to laugh at people back in the 1700s that did goofy things to cure themselves or, you know, whatever it is that we like to laugh at that they did because they were so ignorant. You know, that's how they're going to look at us. That we actually called ourselves a democracy and that we lived with this freedom. And, in fact, we had zero say in anything that went on. Zero say in anything that went on. Zero is the number. Zero. Zero. All right? Zero. So hopefully this tape will survive the 200 years so they see that there was one madman that was in a room full of his associate, you know, lunatics. They realize this. All right, who's next?
Hi, Michael. Mark from Green Bay, Wisconsin. During the Quebec demonstrations, when indie media was putting pictures up on the internet for the whole world to see seconds after cops did certain things to people, the FBI and the Secret Service went into our Seattle offices and attempted to shut the server down, slapped us with a gag order, and demanded 3 days worth of DNS entries, which we refused to give. The gag order allowed us to not discuss the fact that we had been shut down. Breaking the gag order, a bunch of us, but I emailed like just every damn person I knew that could probably maybe help to do something. People at NPR, Matt Drudge, people at Fox, people at EFF. How come John Perry Barlow is the only person at 2 o'clock in the morning that emailed me back in about 5 minutes? Is it maybe there's a cultural revolution going on where, like, musicians, artists, web designers are either sucking corporate dick or they're just writing content for themselves and their own audience?
Well, I think you answered your own question.
But could you discuss that?
I've met very few people in the particular business I have now fallen into that, I don't know what to say. I mean, I'm constantly amazed at the at why people who I think are good people are afraid to rock the boat in the media business. Whenever we like start a new season of whatever new show it is that I can get on the air or whatever, the first thing I say to the staff at the beginning of the first day, is that you all need to work on this show like you're never going to work again in network television. You must have this attitude that this is your last job, that nobody will want to touch you after you work here. Because if you work with the intent of being here to put something on your resume or to get ahead in this business of film and television, then I really don't want to be working with you, because I operate with a total sense of I could give a shit about any of this. I don't give a damn about any of it. And there's no number you can name that's going to make me change a single thing that I believe in. And if you don't share that, then you can't work here. Now, saying that means I find very few people that want to work under those conditions, because we live with a sphere that, well, I got to get another job, or I got to, you know, this, that, or whatever. And so, but I personally operate with that attitude. And the funny thing is that I found that the more that I have that attitude, the more work I tend to get. The doors don't shut. That's what I found. This is something I read Spike Lee's book when he made She's Gotta Have It, his first film. And he was amazed at how just the things he would ask for, he would get. And he was surprised. He wondered why, especially black filmmakers, don't ask the studios to do things like hire more blacks on the set, do these sorts of things. And so when I was negotiating with Warner Brothers, and I didn't have a lawyer or an agent, I just had this guy who was kind of helping me through this whole thing. And he was, you know, I was saying, why don't we just see what we can get from them, you know, on this, and maybe they'll be willing to help out. So I said, well, if you're going to buy this film, one of the things you got to do is you got to house all the people that are evicted in the film by the deputy sheriff. You've got to house them for 2 years. You got to pay their rent or their mortgage or whatever for 2 years. And they went, okay. Just like that. It was like, wow. Let's see, what else? You got to send this film with a group of unemployed people from Flint, Michigan, to 30 depressed cities just like Flint, and have free screenings of it and organize groups in these communities so they can go there and actually do some grassroots work. And that'll cost $250,000 to create that depressed city tour. Okay. And it was like, you know, geez, it's like all these people in the media, they're so afraid to ask, so afraid to stand up, so afraid to do something. And, you know, the reason why the powers that be will say okay to a lot of that is because they believe we won't ever really have any impact to begin with. They're so convinced that we're so far out there that nothing will ever happen. And it's to our benefit that they continue to think that. To me, it's always been highly ironic that the stuff I do is the antithesis of everything that they believe in. So why do they put me on? You know, I just finished writing my next book. It's being published by Rupert Murdoch. You know, that you can't get more of a polar opposite than that, right? So why do they do this? Why do they do this? Well, I think, this is capitalism 101. They do it because people will buy it. And as long as, you see, this is what's always got me, is that they believe that there's a bigger audience for my stuff out there than I believe there is. They believe our numbers are much larger than we know what they actually are. And because of that, they'll actually put up the money to let me do this because they'll make money. And that is the bottom line for them. Ultimately, it's not about politics or political feelings. It is about what's going to make them the most amount of money. And as long as I've made them money and all the stuff I've done has made them millions or they can sell Doritos on the show, you know, I don't get a lot of, like, you know, I rarely get any kind of political discussion about the content. You know, it's all about it's 30 seconds too long. We're going to lose a Dorito commercial. You know, that's the discussion that takes place. And I think, well, you know, it's they're counting on the fact that you, the audience, after you get done watching my show or reading my book, are going to put the book down and continue to sit on your ass and do nothing. They're so sure that you're going to do that that they can put out this little money and make it look like that they're, you know, magnanimous, and that, oh, they see we have all points of view here at our publishing house or on our network, you know, and makes, you know what I'm saying? They're so convinced that it's not a threat, that this is just a joker doing his little joker routine for some little entertainment for the people sitting home in their lazy boys, and that when it's over, they will just get the remote and flip to The Simpsons or some other radical entertainment that also won't make them get up off their ass and do anything. That's what they're counting on. I'm counting on the opposite. I'm counting on the fact that I think enough people will get enthused, inspired, regenerated, whatever it takes to get up and do something locally or nationally or whatever, and that's the battle. They believe one thing, I believe another thing. It's a race to the finish. I hope we are the ones, you know, who will win that race. But what I try to tell people, and so, you know, I've been doing these, I've done a couple music videos here in the last year, and so I've kind of run into the whole MTV world in a way that I hadn't run into it before. And but I did these two videos for Rage Against the Machine, which of course is, that's another group of people that are, you know, much like, you know, what we do, and they're, you know, not easily, you can't turn their heads with a dollar bill. That's not what's going to, if you try to do that, you're going to end up in, you know, they're not pacifists like me. So, so anyways, I'm sorry, yakking on so long here.
It's perfect segue, because I'd like you to talk a little bit about how you organize the power of that news, of the power of a newsletter during the Monica thing, where at one point you emailed us saying, if each of you have forwarded this to 10 people, we've reached 1 million people. I forwarded it to 50 to 100 each time. Each person that I would send, I'd get all kinds of emails saying, thanks, I've forwarded it on. And your point was to pull the humor you had in Downsize Us and your movies and turn it into a newsletter. A lot of people want to do it, but you really moved it. And I'd love to know what some of your mechanics are that we could use. You were exposing hypocrisy, showing that, hey, you know, you're going to throw stones. This is what you did. You licked the whipped cream off, and we found out. Just give us a little sense of how you set that up.
Well, I saw the attempt to impeach Clinton by the radical Christian right as a much larger thing. To me, I could care less about Clinton or what he did or this or that. What I saw was an attempt for them to impose their particular set of values on all of us, and would have horrible repercussions if they were to succeed. And so I made a decision, not having voted for Clinton in 1996, and not at all being a big supporter of him. If you read my stuff, you're familiar with that. But accepting that what this battle really was, and seeing it in the way that I saw it. So I did. I sent this letter out. This is the most amazing thing, because I there is no way to know how many people got this particular letter. I certainly I was getting about. It started out at about 3,000 emails a day, and I, you know, it only holds 1,000, so I'd have to go in and just download or just cancel all of them, and just, you know, another 1,000 would pop up there in a few hours. I was just stunned by the amount of mail that this got, and then I got the head of the Channel 4, which is a network in Britain that funds us, because after the NBC and Fox thing, I decided it was. Probably easier to get foreign countries to fund this stuff. So a lot of the Brits and the Canadians and Germans and Irish and others are, you know, fund a lot of our work now, and Australians. That was a Murdoch reference. Anyways, I got the head of the Channel 4 network in Britain got invited to a White House dinner, and he said, "Do you want to go as my date?" And I said, "Yeah, okay." You know, the British, you know, they're all into that date thing. And so I went to this White House dinner, and it was the night before the impeachment vote. And it was on a big tent out on the White House lawn, and I don't know, somebody was singing or playing. I don't know, Bon Jovi actually was. So I had to go take a leak, and so they had these porta potties back behind the tent, and there's two porta potties, and I went up and tried one, and it was locked, and so I went in the other one. I went in, it was really nice porta potties, had sink and a little flower, and smelled nice, and it was really, it was almost like a woman's porta john, because it's a joke, you know, so you got it, yeah, sorry. But that's the worst thing about being a guy, in my humble opinion, is having to use a men's room. Anyways, so I hear the water in the john next to mine, and I want to get back to Bon Jovi. So I don't wash my hands, and I open my door. He opens his door, and it's Clinton, and he sees me, and he holds out his hand, and you know, "Mike, I'm so happy to see you here." You know, he's like, and I haven't washed my hand, and I'm like, you know, shaking his hand. And of course, that morning he had just bombed Iraq and killed who knows how many civilians. So I'm thinking, this guy has blood on his hands. Fuck the washing the pee off it, you know. So he goes, I just want to thank you for that letter that you sent out on the internet. That was like, you know, it was just so wonderful you did that. It was just, you know. You know, I thought he was going to start crying, you know. I said, "Hey, man, I didn't do it for you. No offense, but, you know." I said, "But, you know, I got to tell you something. I've never thought I'd have a chance to talk to you directly. You know, your mom raised you, you know, pretty much as a single mother for most of your childhood, and when you weren't, you know, living with your grandparents. And, you know, she worked the night shift as a nurse emptying bedpans and stuff. You come from we come from the working class. You're one of us. You know, and I just feel that somewhere, you know, you lost your way here. But even though you've lost your way, you'll always be one of us. You'll always be from the working class."
I know I am.
I said, "No, seriously, I mean this very sincerely, because you have to understand why the forces of evil have gotten as far as they've gotten here against you. Because you felt that by being part of them, that somehow this would be good, and I understand that. And, you know, anybody when you are raised poor, you think, boy, if you just get your foot in the door, you know, you get that scholarship, you get that thing, you get them, maybe they'll like me, maybe it'll be better, you know." And so, he goes, "Have you met the so and so here who's running Al Gore's campaign?" He's like trying to change the subject. It was just weird hearing him thank me for this, that he had actually seen this letter that had gone out on the internet, and telling me that he felt that it had some kind of an impact. But on the other hand, you know, I'm bothered by it too, because you know, if he should be impeached, it should be for, you know, what he's done to the poor, or what he's done in this bombing campaign, or this, that, or whatever, you know. And it's like that's that gets lost in the whole muddied picture of the whole thing. But I don't know if I answered your question very well, but I think that I have found that it's best to, if you're going to write political letters or have a political zine, that you not be strident in your thing so that only your friends like it. That you've got to find a way to open up and reach out to other people. And, you know, I mean, that's why, even though I have voted for Nader and I supported Nader and campaigned for Ralph, but, well, some places that gets me a lot of boos. Let's hear the boos. And but what I said from the very beginning on my website and through all the letters is that I don't want to convince a single Al Gore voter to change his vote. If you think Gore is the best guy, you vote for him. My concern is that there's going to be about 100 million people in this country who aren't going to vote at all. And I want to appeal to them. I want to say to them, you don't like Gore, you don't like Bush, there's an alternative. You can make your voice heard, you can come out and take a stand. And you know, say something about it, but I don't want to get too deep into that. And I've just written a whole bunch about it in this book that's coming out, so it's you can read about it in there. But it there's a lot of stuff behind the scenes and stuff I wanted to say for a long time, and I went down to Tallahassee 10 days before the election and had this thing happen between me and Jeb Bush, and but it's a too long of a story to tell tonight, and there's other people that need to speak here. But who's next? I'm sorry.
Another pre-boomer. I'm a little bit ahead of the boomer.
You're a pre-boomer?
Generation. Yeah, right.
Well, you're not born, as hated as much, though.
Born in 43. And I'm, you know, another of the old farts that are up here to make a comment and then ask a question. It's very... I'm very gratified, and I want to thank you for our generation, and that you have kept the spirit of the 60s and of what we, when we were the average age of most of the people that are here, what we tried to do in the 60s to awaken the spirit of what this country was founded on, the spirit of revolution, the spirit of that individually and in groups that we could make a difference. And we in the 60s, we did, took goddamn long time, but we took the biggest country in the world and we stopped the war. We stopped the war that was wrong, that was evil, and that was immoral. And we did stop a racial policy that was wrong. It's still many, many three decades later, we have a lot of work to do. But it's still so gratifying for me to hear someone of my generation that's still willing to speak out with such heart and with such truth of how much further we have done when most of our generation has sold out and has forgotten that and has become the establishment that in our callow youth we were so willing to rebel against. And now we've become it. And my view on the election was that this was the best that our generation could give. I don't think so. They were the worst and the dumbest of our generation. In any event, you mentioned that you're supported so much from Ireland, from England, from Australia, and that brings up that word globalization. And with the internet and the power of the internet being that we can connect not just within our communities, not just within the within our country, but the power of the internet to connect with other countries, how you're able to use that power. Because I think that the nation state, we have become the evil empire, quite frankly, of how you are able to use and how you envision using the internet to connect with people, say, with the Big 8 meeting in Genoa as right now today.
Right. The first of all, the internet's allowed me to be able to get my work out to people in other countries, and there's a group of volunteers in France who on their own translate my website into French, and we have a link to it. And so if you don't speak English and you speak French, you can read it. And now there's a group of Spanish-speaking people that are going to do that, and so it'll be in Spanish. My show is on right now. But when my show is on broadcast television in other countries, it's not on in cable or satellite. It's on like 10 p.m. on whatever their ABC or CBS is. So I get a lot of mail from Australia, from Scandinavia, from Israel, from the 20 countries that it's playing in. So, and my book got up to number 6 on the bestseller list in France. This past year, my last book. So, and the big one just set a box office record there. It played 13 months straight in the movie theaters and surpassed the box office here in the U.S. So it's, but that's all, this at the foundation of all this is the internet. That's how that initial group of people found out about me, and it was on the web. And boy, I just think it's a great thing that we can come together like that. And of course, the last few days I've been getting all this stuff of what's going on in Italy, all these reports, and trying to, maybe this is a good point or a good time now to make an appeal here, which is one of the reasons I was glad to be invited to come down here tonight, is that it's very hard for me to keep my website going. This is not a pitch for money, by the way. Mainly because I'm just so busy trying to get my next film done and get this, the book done and whatever. But I used to have a guy that did the website, and then he moved to Cuba or whatever. And he was doing a really good job. And now I've got this guy who up in Massachusetts who's just trying to keep the thing going just so that there's something up there. But I have had a difficult time trying to find somebody who can do both the physical design stuff and the content. And now I don't know if this is a common problem or what. Usually someone's very talented in creating the look and the design of the website, but they're not writers, or they're not editorial content is not their forte, and those who write are not very artistic. I don't know if there's anybody here tonight, or if you want to see me afterwards, or if you want to send me an email. We're trying to figure out what to do, because actually we've been talking about shutting it down for a while, just because I'm unable to, as I'm completing this film, keep the thing going. But I just feel like all the stuff that people have sent me from Italy today, and I can't get it up on the website because I don't have a means, to do that. If there's anybody in here who feels that they're on our wavelength and has checked out the site and the kinds of things that we say or do or whatever, and also has the whatever that artistic thing is that I completely lack, I would really please get a hold of me, because I need help. So you can write me at Michael Moore Flint, like the town, that's with an I, not a Y. And that's at AOL.com. And michaelmoore.com is the website. But we have a very nice gentleman now that's been just great in trying to help us just keep some sort of presence going with it. So, yeah.
Hi, sir. Ken Munshine, corporatemofo.com. My day job, I work for a very large educational publishing corporation doing editing social studies textbooks. Great propaganda machine, I'm sure. But I was wondering, what in your opinion would be the number one subversive thing I could work into these textbooks I do for this very, very large and personal Fortune 500 corporation that might, sort of raise the consciousness of the next generation? Thank you.
Well, the Flint sit-down strike is, something that should be in these books. Somebody just sent me, I don't know, some Houghton Mifflin or something. I don't know who it was. I just They just sent me a high school history book that has Roger and me in it. I was like stunned to see that. That was, you know, somebody's going to get fired for that, I'm sure. So, but I think the history of unions or unions and that sort of thing, something that young people are not taught anything about. And I think anything in there that shows them how the individual, oftentimes it's the average individual, not some famous person, but the average person that does make a change, that makes a difference. Anything along those lines is something that would be great to get into our textbooks. Yeah, who's next?
I'm told I'm the last question.
Last question?
This is the last question, yes. Yeah. Okay.
I have an interesting story. I have an interesting story that some people have probably heard before. I spoke last year at Webster.
Can you guys hear him?
I'm sorry. I have an interesting story that I told last year at Webzine that I think Michael might be interested in because it took place in Traverse City, Michigan, which I know Michael has a summer house there. I am from Michigan myself. I'm sorry. Eat the mic. Okay. All right. Is that better?
Why do you call it summer house?
Sorry. I'm sorry?
Why do you call it a summer house? I live there.
You live there. You have an apartment here, too.
I have
an
apartment here when I have to work here. Yeah.
That's okay. About 4 years ago, 4.5 years ago, I was fired from my job for publishing fiction online. And I'd like Michael to comment on the strength of employers and how they can affect somebody's personal life and what kind of powers they have over what somebody does outside the workplace.
You mean you were publishing fiction on the and your, I understand, your employer, on you mean you were doing it on company time?
Nope, I was doing it in my own time, and it was publishing it on my own computers, my own money, publishing it on my own website, and my employer and some of his employees did not like the fiction that I was writing. And my boss decided to fire me because of that.
Wow. Yeah, geez, I'd sue them, you know.
I spoke with several ACLU lawyers who said that there was very little I could do because it did not tie into any one of the protected classes like sex or religion.
Are you doing okay now?
Oh, I'm fine now.
Oh, don't worry about it then. No, seriously, you know, you're going to get fucked over 5 more times in your lifetime. So, you know, you just move on and fight the bastards on another day. Eventually they'll lose because they're not good people. And, you know, maybe I'm just too much of an optimist with this stuff, but I think that the worst thing that could happen if you stop publishing your fiction or stop doing what you're doing. Have you stopped that?
Oh, no, I still publish.
Oh, yeah. Well, then you see you're okay and you got food on the table.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, well, there's 3 billion people on this planet that don't have clean water tonight, clean drinking water, and a billion that have zero, have no electricity. They couldn't even hook up a computer if they wanted to. 1 billion people on this planet. There are a lot of problems, you know, in this world, and not to diminish yours, I just have learned. Well, I've been through the same sort of thing, and I just learned that it's best to fight them on another day and move on and do the work that you need to do. Don't get caught up and hung up in the stuff, because we have to win this battle. It is a battle that's going on, you know. And we've got the people on our side. We are the majority. The majority of these people in this country believe in free speech and a free press. The majority of people in this country want to be hooked up to the internet. They don't want the government intruding upon them. You know, and the majority of people want to know that they can have some impact if they do fight City Hall. So I think it's you know, important to focus on that and to do that sort of thing. And I who are these people that did this to you?
Oh, I'm reluctant to name the company.
Why? Because you're afraid they'll sue you, or
no? Because it's in my past, and it's not something that.
Oh, so you're already, because you already got over it. You got over it, what,
I got
like
over
2 minutes ago?
Yeah, 3 years ago.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's good. That's a good sign. He's already past it. No,
but it is an important story to tell, that people know that you can be fired from your job for publishing.
Yeah, but don't
online.
Scare them with that. Don't scare them with that.
It does happen, though. It happens to me.
Well, good. Maybe you should be fired. No, maybe you shouldn't be working there then. Fuck them. You shouldn't. You don't work for those people. You know. Don't feed that kind of beast. You know. Seriously. Do always be yourself. Print your fiction. Do whatever you want, and expect to be fired and fired again and again and again. I can't tell how many times I've either been fired, my show's been canceled, my book contract's been ripped up. I don't give a shit. You know. What can they do? What can they do? You know. They can't buy bullets at Kmart anymore. You know. At least I'm semi-safe. Well, in closing, I should tell just briefly the AOL story. This is part of the boomer curse, which is, you know, 7 years ago I got a free disc in the mail, and I didn't know what it was. That's true. I said to my, hey, we got a free disc. I'm gonna go online. So I got it, and then I made a huge mistake of in my book 5 years ago putting it in the book. Here's how you can contact me. And the AOL, unlike other, which I learned much later, will not forward your mail. So now here's a book of mine that's taught in colleges and high schools all over the country, printed with that email address in it. And also I put it at the end of my film, the film before that. And it's like, now what do I do? Because I don't want them not to be able to get a hold of me. And so we went and got, michaelmoore.com, and you can write me at mike@michaelmoore.com. But it's like, so I've hung on to this thing because it's the public thing. But it's so weird. But then I thought, well, you know, it's like the young woman here. Yes. You have a solution for this? Or what's I've been waiting for somebody to tell me how to. No, I've been told. And you can't do it with, you don't know what you're talking about. You can't, no, believe me. Okay. I need somebody with a subversive idea. Exactly. Right.
They don't allow that.
Right, they won't allow it.
Juno doesn't allow that, and they don't allow that. Every other ISP in the world.
And so I still get 1,000 emails a day, and a lot of them are from young people and students, and it's more important for me to be able to direct them or answer their questions or do whatever than to make my statement. You know, I'm wearing Levi's jeans. What do I got here? Oh, well, there was an Avion up here earlier. But you know what I'm saying? I mean, don't get hung up with being so pure. Do the work you need to do. Avoid them as much as you can. But you got to live in the real world. You're not going to go live in a cave and be a hermit. So don't have those kind of arguments with each other. And just accept, as I said to you about the McDonald's thing, that ultimately you're a flawed person. You should not just use that as an excuse. You should try to get better and not do those things. And, well, I'm never going to be a vegetarian, ma'am. So that's, I come from the Midwest. We eat vegetarians. We don't become them. But I should eat more vegetables. And I haven't had beef in like 4 years because I got sick of watching myself 1,000 times in the editing room of eating that Big Mac. I was just like, it's just, I wanted to puke. And so that helped, it was I'm sorry you had to watch it so that I could go through my own therapy. So that's just the way it is. I love chicken and fish. Anyways, what was I going to say in closing? No, people don't hate you for being a vegetarian. No, everyone here actually loves you and admires you and thinks that you'll live longer than we will, and you will. So God bless you. Let's all have a round of applause for the vegetarians. I guess what I want to say in closing is that the work that you're doing, especially those of you who have your own zines, is very important work. And I would love it if you'd send me a letter with a link or whatever. I'm always looking to put up links. When I get the website set up the way I'd love to get it set up, if I could find somebody that wants to do this with me, I would love to just make these zines available to people and just have continuous, links or change them each week or whatever. But just, two different months in the last year, I had over 1 million hits on my website. And I don't want to put any advertising on it, and I don't want, you know, any money made off it, but I'm trying to figure out a way. How do you, I don't know the way to make it work, but, you know, if there's anybody here that would like to send me a note or a letter or tell me whatever, that would be great. But in the meantime, keep doing your work, and I'll try and help you through my site with the work you're doing. I mean that. That's not just an offer I'm throwing out there. I really, truly believe that this is at the core of whatever social change is going to happen in the next decade. It's here. It's in this room. You know, you'll look back on this 5 or 10 years. We were in the basement of a funky bar in the East Village. And, you know, you're gonna remember a lot of these people you met, because they will have created an enormous impact in a very good way in our society. And so make use of this time that you've spent here with each other, and go back home and do some good with it. And don't ever, ever, ever let the bastards get you down, because that's all they are just bastards. And we're doing the good work. So thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Michael Moore's keynote speech at Webzine 2001. If you'd like to start a Webzine event in your city and help celebrate independent publishing online, please visit our website at www.webzine.ws. The Webzine event would like to thank Michael Moore, our event sponsors, and all those who support independent publishing.